Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Navarapu, the host of this channel, and today I'm in conversation with Dr. Jacob Lederman about his new book, Chasing World-Class Urbanism, Global Policy versus Everyday Survival in Buenos Aires. This book was published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2020. Dr. Lederman is Associate Professor of Sociology at University of Michigan Flint, and his research interests span urban sociology, development and globalization, and political economy. Welcome, Jacob, to the show. It is such a pleasure to have you here today, and congratulations on this fantastic book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So can we maybe start this conversation off with getting to know you a bit better? So how did you become a sociologist?
Yeah, so that is, for me, something of an accident. I had... studied actually economics as an undergrad in New York City, and also taken a lot of Spanish and Latin American literature courses. You know, like any really thoughtful 21-year-old, when I graduated, I sort of somewhat randomly decided that it was a good idea to go teach English in Argentina. I think I vaguely sort of liked the literature I had read in some of my classes from Argentina, and that was really the crux of the decision. And, you know, Buenos Aires in particular, as I think a lot of people would say, is a fairly complex and fascinating place for sociologists for so many reasons. But once there, I think I really found myself without the tools, at least from my economics training, to understand what was happening in the city. As I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit, you know, the city was recovering from an economic crisis. And some of the processes that I was interested in with no sociological training, in fact, I had never even taken a sociology class, I think I realized were at least somewhat related to sociology as a discipline. And so some of those kinds of issues in terms of class relations in the city and kind of comparative aspects of racialization in Buenos Aires versus where I was coming from in New York City really fascinated me. And once again, without a ton of foresight or really that much thoughtfulness, I think once I got back after teaching English there for a couple of years, I decided to enroll in a PhD program. And, you know, the rest is sort of history, though I do now kind of laugh at the fact that I so spontaneously applied to these programs without really any training and very little idea, frankly, of what the discipline of sociology was. But I feel sort of fortunate that I did, because I think in a lot of ways, the discipline did give me a lot of the tools that helped me to understand the kinds of processes I was interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And you know, the book that's come out of your long engagement with sociology in Buenos Aires is an exploration of urban development and reinvestment in the city in the aftermath of Argentina's 2001-2 economic crisis. The book examines how the efforts of the local state in Buenos Aires have been shaped by transnational influence in terms of urban policies, design, and normative images of globality, and how the lives of city dwellers are affected by these efforts. So could you tell us a little bit about how this particular book was conceived and how your interest in these research questions unfolded?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one part of that is the economic crisis, which I mentioned a bit at the beginning when I mm-hmm. first moved to Buenos Aires in early 2005. The city was really still recovering from this devastating economic crisis. And I think hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about this a little bit later. But in terms of kind of urban space, there was a whole new level of informality that was, in terms of informal workers, that was populated by kind of the former mm-hmm. local middle class. So people selling wares on the street as a way to make ends meet in the aftermath of crisis. And almost immediately after getting to Buenos Aires, the New York Times and other large kind of northern newspapers and other media outlets started publishing these glowing reviews of the city, which, you know, was sort of interesting to me even at the time prior to being a sociologist, because only a couple of years before, the global press was writing that, you know, Argentina was an economic basket case, that the city's, for example, the city's poverty rate was soaring to 50% of the population. And so I, you know, it made me think a little bit more about how these processes today, especially in terms of tourism and the kinds of cultural production that come with it, how they're shaped by these broader economic patterns. So fast forward a few years, well into my PhD program, I think my initial project was to look at gentrification in the historic center of the city. Mm-hmm. And during a summer of kind of pre-dissertation research, I think in 2012, I was in Buenos Aires for a few months and, you know, found myself sort of interested in what was going on in the historic center. But I also started to notice these other changes in the city, which somewhat paradoxically reminded me of what was going on in Michael Bloomberg's New York City, where I was mm-hmm. coming from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a few blocks away in the kind of historic downtown banking district, they were pedestrianizing streets. They were creating bike lanes and bike shares. Mm-hmm. And I found this really fascinating because this was a conservative administration doing these kinds of things. And I think, you know, hopefully I'll have a little time to talk more about this in a few moments. But I think there was a kind of key insight I gleaned in interviewing a pretty high-level official in the Office of Urban Development, who basically told me that the city's 1990s like redevelopment of the waterfront, which was, you know, very homogeneously upper class, very securitized, etc., mm-hmm. wasn't a successful project because it didn't promote social inclusion. And again, I found this kind of odd knowing this particular minister of urban development who was quite conservative and part of a conservative administration. So I think it kind of told me something at the time about how global models of urban design and development were kind of circulating around the world and how, mm-hmm. at least on the surface, they tended to promote these notions of sustainability and livability, equity, etc. And I won't say too much about this now, but I think that insight made me start digging a little more into who was promoting these kinds of models and how city officials came to support them, to implement them, and frankly, why they wanted to do so. And what I started to see was that there was this kind of network of NGOs and experts and futurists and like thought leaders in sort of urban development that really were traversing the globe, and certainly were more centered in the global north, but were active in cities across Latin America. Mm-hmm. And that many of these cities, but particularly in Buenos Aires, were drawing inspiration from these models. And I think crucially for me, they were drawing inspiration from models that appeared to be very invested in a kind of equity priority. So many mm-hmm. of the things that those of us who live in cities, at least in North America, are probably familiar with, the kind of notion of sustainability and livability. And so I sort of started to wonder how those kinds of discourses did indeed, or in fact didn't, promote equity. And what I started to find was that when you dug a little deeper, a lot of those paradigms actually promoted new forms of exclusion, and a very sort of upper class idea of what the urban core should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, as you were speaking, I was even more curious to know a little bit about the methods that you used to do your research.
Yeah. So those changed also as this project evolved. And they're really, I would say, you know, relative to a lot of my friends and colleagues who I think mm-hmm. have much more straightforward, say, ethnographies. Mm-hmm. I used a variety of methods, and I wouldn't really call myself an ethnographer, though there are some ethnographic moments and a kind of ethnographic or a chapter that's much more ethnographic. Mm-hmm. I would say the bulk of my research consisted of about 49 qualitative interviews, largely with folks like city officials. So I was very fortunate in this regard, and I think it really helped me to be able to do this project. And that was because a friend of mine who I met through a friend in Buenos Aires worked for the party that ran the city. And much to my surprise, sort of high-level urban officials, for whatever reason, were very open to meeting with me. Something I found curious, and I think scholars, you know, scholars from the global north, especially those working in the global south, I think often find this, where your local colleagues can't get those kinds of meetings.
Right.
And for whatever reason, local officials found themselves more interested or more open to speaking to me about these issues. So mm-hmm. that I felt like was a stroke of luck. And it's one of the things I think about in terms of methodology, because it was really crucial to understanding these stories mm-hmm. Of the kind of global travels of urban policy models to be able to interview kind of people or hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And so mm-hmm. that was a big part of my research. But as the research progressed, I found all of these connections between local officials and mostly northern NGOs and think tanks, mm-hmm. Climate philanthropies, organizations like C40 or the Institute for Transportation Development Policy. And these are organizations that are working all over the world. And so I did get a chance to interview a number of those individuals working there as well. And then finally, I did a lot of work with kind of local community members, local shopkeepers. So I began my interest, as I mentioned, in the historic center. And I was sort of curious about how the commercial character of some of the major streets in the historic center were changing, and how what the experience of informal vendors, who were sort of the least privileged agents of commerce in the neighborhood, how they experienced those changes. So I would say the rest of my interviews were with people like that, as well as kind of just more ethnographic, like attending community meetings, talking to people informally after those. There was a lot of pushback on the local state's efforts in some of these neighborhoods. So attending some of those community meetings was also really crucial for thinking about the kind of relationship between these global paradigms on the one hand and how they impact everyday residents on the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really beautifully put. And I thought that the way you integrated your, you know, the analysis of policy documents, as well as the interviews with some of the ethnographic components was actually, it provided a really nice balance and took us around different sites of inquiry, you know, and I thought that was really cool. So diving straight into the book now. In the first part of the book, you show how and why Buenos Aires became a tourist and travel destination right after the economic devastation in 2001-2002. So can you tell us a little bit about the mechanisms through which this unfolded, the making of Buenos Aires as a tourist destination, and who were the important political actors that were involved in this transformation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is kind of the key way I try to frame the kind of history of the book is through this kind of break that happens after the economic crisis of 2001 and 2002, and sort of how this ushers in this more entrepreneurial approach to local culture and tourism and in turn, urban development. And what I found was that, so Buenos Aires during the 1990s, to kind of zoom out into this more macroeconomic perspective, was very much part of the Washington consensus at the time. They had pegged the peso, the local currency, to the US dollar at 1-to-1, which on the one hand, many middle-class Argentines appreciated given the history of inflation in Argentina. So this basically ended inflation from one day to the next. But it also made Argentina extremely expensive. That's a kind of a different story, perhaps, of how it decimated local industries. But basically overnight, following the economic crisis, federal officials devalued the currency. And Buenos Aires went from being one of the most expensive cities in the world, really, to one of the cheapest. And so this is where you start with this kind of global media buzz around Buenos Aires as this place that is, I think, at once familiar to Northern Hemisphere travelers, where a lot of these media publications were emanating from. And there's a whole set of interesting questions there, the way the city's modernity is kind of racialized by those publications, right? As many people know, Buenos Aires is also often framed as this sort of European outpost in Latin America, mostly due to the large amount of European immigration that took place in the early part of the 20th century, but also because of the kinds of architectural idioms that characterize the city center. So we saw this expansion, this very rapid expansion of tourism in the city. And I think for a city that was really reeling from unemployment and poverty, this was a kind of lifeline for local officials. And so some of those actors were officials who, on the one hand, saw tourism as one of the few bright spots following the economic crisis. And I'll just say, and perhaps we'll get to this a little later, I think some of these, during the period of the early 2000s, this was a kind of leftist progressive mayor and city government. And I think they really grappled with this sort of deeply, this kind of tension between commodifying the city's culture and kind of going all in on tourism and culture in a way that was very commercializing of local cultural identity and sort of how to balance that with the needs of everyday residents. So sort of the progressive government, the way that it sort of started to work that out is by coming up with this vision of sort of cultural identity and cultural tourism that was much more about maybe exchange than simply the commodification of urban culture. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what I do in chapter 2 and 3 of the book is look at that tightrope act and sort of how that sets the city up for a much more entrepreneurial and frankly, much more typical use of culture in urban development. So the sort of leftist city government is reinvesting in the historic center, but thinking about how that impacts lower income populations there, how they can promote cross-cultural exchange. So this sort of more cosmopolitan vision of cultural tourism. And despite perhaps good intentions, the ground has really been laid for the next mayor, Mauricio Macri, who comes in and I think is much less ambivalent about that kind of project.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting, and it provides, like, I think the perfect grounds for me to ask my next question, which is, I really enjoyed your emphasis on the role of political orientations in modifying and shaping the intentions of multiple city administrations. But like more specifically, I really liked your emphasis on the local political orientation. I was hoping you could walk us through a few examples of the kinds of frictions and contradictions that were generated in the process of transforming Buenos Aires.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that comes to mind just as like a sort of first stab at this, this wasn't something I was very aware of while I was on the ground, but there was an Afro-Argentine cultural center that in, I believe, like 2010 or 11, the city government, the conservative city government, had given a cultural space in the historic center. And apparently, at least according to media reports at the time, the group who had been given this space wasn't using it as a kind of space for entertaining outsiders. They were using it for their own kinds of political projects and processes and forms of cultural identity. And in a kind of telling interview, the city's minister of tourism said that he regretted giving them this space because he thought they were going to do something that would attract the whole city and outsiders, tourists, and instead they were just using it for themselves. I think this was a kind of interesting anecdote for me because it sort of spoke to this tension, like on the one hand, promoting local forms of cultural identity, which had been a hallmark of both of these administrations that I just mentioned, but at the same time, seeking ways to commodify that cultural identity. And I think one thing that I was very interested in is sort of how those two administrations managed this very differently. Mm-hmm. And I guess I came up with the way I sort of defined that was that the prior administration had this more sort of cosmopolitan vision of the city, which still sought to promote tourism and economic development, but it was much more about cultural exchange. I think one of the reasons why I like this chapter, which is chapter 3 of the book, is that I do think there's a tendency among many of us, including myself, I think, to see everything through this paradigm of the neoliberal entrepreneurial city. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, I actually do think the Macri government that came to office later very much saw the city in those terms. Mm-hmm. But what I thought was kind of interesting was this sort of older form of cosmopolitanism that had existed in the city, that, you know, cultural tourism wasn't completely new, mm-hmm. and cultural exchange, of course, wasn't completely new. And so I found it kind of interesting how this progressive administration sought to borrow from these kinds of older idioms. But I also mm-hmm. thought it was interesting because it suggests the limits to that approach. As time went on, that administration, the progressive administration, increasingly had to contend with processes of commodification if they wanted to see increased economic development and increased tourism. And so while in the first years of their administration, they were part of social movements that were dedicated to protecting intellectual property rights, for example, of cultural producers in Latin America, that were very critical of Northern development institutions and the global kind of culture industry. And as time went on, I think they abandoned this for a slightly more pragmatic orientation towards these kinds of processes. And so I think one of the things that it shows is that at least within the jurisdiction of cities, mm-hmm. it's very hard to contend with these global forces. So when the possibility of increased revenue coming into the city through tourism presents itself, I think in the end, many city officials felt quite compelled to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, that's really illuminating, and I think sums up a lot of the key concerns that you walk us through in the book. So your deep dive into the historic neighborhood of San Telmo reveals how the concept of gentrification might work a bit differently in non-Western contexts, even if it is class-based exclusion that is the end result. So I wanted to invite you to tell us a little bit about the processes of reinvestment and redevelopment in San Telmo and how they provoke us to rethink what Western scholarship often glosses over as gentrification.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's an area that I remain really interested in and sort of in some ways stumbled upon. And I should say, on the one hand, I started this project thinking about gentrification. That was also probably a result in part of my dissertation advisor, who has written quite a bit about that. And in some ways, when writing the book years later, after doing the research, I was very hesitant to engage this topic. For those who do work on kind of gentrification studies, there's just so much literature out there. Right. And sometimes for me, at least, those debates can seem a little arcane. You know, people fighting over very narrow conceptual differences for decades, basically. Right. And so I was always a little bit worried about wading too deeply into this topic. But I do think there's something here that is very interesting. And I have to say, I borrowed a bit from Asher Gertner, who has done work in Delhi and elsewhere. And in kind of asking how class relations shape how we frame gentrification. And so what I found in the historic center of Buenos Aires, for example, was that there was reinvestment and there certainly were new people moving in. A lot of those new people were tourists and students from abroad. Mm-hmm. And fewer of them were the kind of sort of sweat equity, middle class, cappuccino drinkers that are the lure of the sort of disciplinary take on gentrification over the years. Mm-hmm. And so it did sort of raise this question of like how we think about class relations in cities like Buenos Aires. And I do think there's application to other cities in the global South. Mm-hmm. So in San Telmo, one of the historic neighborhoods, but the sort of heart of the historic center of Buenos Aires, you see much more commercial gentrification than residential. So, stores are clearly changing very rapidly, and residents are changing too, but you see far fewer wealthy residents of Buenos Aires moving from the sort of posh neighborhoods of the city into the former housing of the poor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a key difference when you think about gentrification in kind of the North Atlantic context. And so it raises a host of questions about like thinking comparatively about processes of social stigma, mm-hmm. about class relations, et cetera. And so again, borrowing from Gertner a bit, one of the things he talks about is if accumulation by dispossession is a more apt term for what goes on in some of these cities. Mm-hmm. And I sort of liked that. So I believe that's a term coined by the geographer David Harvey, mm-hmm. to think about processes of expropriation mm-hmm. that are class-based. And usually this involves some level of force. So in thinking about San Telmo, the kind of consumer residential choice paradigm that often characterizes some cities in the North Atlantic, where rents are driven up, wealthy people from other parts of the city move in and displace lower income residents, mm-hmm. was there in a very minor way, at least in my research. And what we did see a lot of, for example, is hotels that had been converted into single room occupancy, so with shared bathrooms and kitchens. So these are large buildings in the historic center that for decades had housed hundreds, often sometimes 200-300 individuals, mm-hmm. being completely dismantled and given to developers for usually hotel development. And the key distinction here, and I can see some people perhaps saying like this isn't that much of a distinction, but I found it useful in my own work. I think the key distinction here is that those buildings often were slated to become hotels oriented toward tourism, mm-hmm. Versus that kind of slow burn consumer residential choice pattern where higher income local residents are moving into the housing of the poor. So I found that to be an interesting distinction. And I'll just say one last thing, kind of going back to this idea of doing a better job historicizing some of the things that we think of as neoliberal urbanism. And to be clear, I'm not one of those people who shies away from using that word. I think it's important. But I will just say, I think looking at San Telmo, doing some archival research, one of the things I found was that this was a neighborhood that had been undergoing processes of change and kind of ushering in more cosmopolitan residents, artists, mm-hmm. bohemians, etc., since the early 70s. And it had always been this very niche kind of movement, as I said, of mm-hmm. higher income residents to the neighborhood. And it raised some questions for me because certainly in 1970 or 71, when I was finding these newspaper clippings mm-hmm. about things that could really only be described as looking like gentrification, there was really no post-industrial kind of structure in Buenos Aires for that, right? This clearly wasn't part of the sort of neoliberal turn in urban governance that we mm-hmm. often think about entailing and ushering in gentrification. Right. So I guess it made me question just sort of more broadly how we historicize these processes and whether that helps us draw different kinds of distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. That was really well put. So you've already spoken about this a little bit, but in chapters 4 and 5, you show how urban policy discourses that seemingly privilege non-market values of sustainability, inclusion, and culture, they end up producing exclusionary outcomes. So in chapter 4, you take the case of bus rapid transit, and in chapter 5, you consider the language of creativity in branding Buenos Aires. Could you walk us through how these exclusionary outcomes are achieved, perhaps with an example or two?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'll just say this is really, if I can say this, my favorite part of the book, if that's the right term.
Yeah.
I think this was the part of the book that was most unexpected for me as I was doing my field work. And really when I got to interview, especially people from international NGOs, there was a lot of clicking that happened for me in terms of like things came together and made a lot more sense in terms of how the city was being redeveloped. I also think these chapters, I hope, shed light on processes in other cities that will be useful to other urbanists, particularly those looking at cities in the global south. So chapter four is looking at bus rapid transit and the transformation of the old kind of banking district. And unfortunately, this is different than the historic center, which is always a little confusing. But and these are projects that all of us would be familiar with: pedestrianization, new bike shares, bike lanes, that kind of thing. And this kind of discourse of not just urban livability and sustainability, which was certainly there, but also urban vibrance and diversity. So I found that to be interesting. Also, the city government promoted this space through a lot of different ways, which I probably don't have time to get into now, as a place of social diversity and vibrancy. And so, you know, again, I thought this was interesting for a city government that most critics accuse of defunding public housing, of dismantling the urban welfare state in a lot of ways. And so it was interesting to think about how they were framing these through these kinds of consensual discourses around livability, sustainability, diversity, and creativity. And so there's a few different things going on in chapter four. One of my questions is, with regard to BRT, where are these models coming from? And are they actually hewing closely to any kind of technical specifications? Or is this more about having something called BRT? So one of the things I found is that city officials often invoked Bogota as a model for their BRT. And yet, when I talked to urban officials, none of the bells and whistles that were evident in the Bogota model existed in Buenos Aires. And in fact, Buenos Aires's BRT was really just dedicated bus lanes without any of the upgrade that had made BRT so successful in a place like Bogota. And so I found this in itself kind of interesting, this process of kind of legitimization. So in order to adopt this policy, which it turned out was being promoted by an international NGO, sustainability NGO, and often funded through agencies like the World Bank, local officials didn't really want to invoke places like New York, even though that's where this NGO was located, right? They wanted to invoke regional examples for, you know, all of the reasons that are probably obvious. They didn't want to be seen as copying a city that I think most local residents would have thought to be not really comparable with Buenos Aires. And so that was one of the key findings, this idea of which models are being selected. But I also found that while a lot of these NGOs, global NGOs, are kind of seeding expertise in the global south. So for example, if you look at this particular NGO that promotes bus rapid transit, of course, they are promoting cities all over the world as models, particularly cities in the global south. But as I started to dig deeper into the kinds of urban networks that Buenos Aires was a part of, I often found that these organizations were headquartered in the global north. And so it raised questions for me as to whether these organizations were kind of seeding expertise in the Global South in order to legitimate models that they were promoting. And I don't mean that to sound conspiratorial or cynical. I think it speaks to a certain way in which development models have shifted from very top-down paradigms in previous generations, and how a more horizontal exchange of knowledge is lauded today. But in fact, at least in this case, is something that I think we need to question more deeply. And so the result, for example, just to use BRT as one example, is that ITDP, the international organization based in New York that focuses on sustainability, was lauding Buenos Aires and awarded it the organization's yearly transportation prize, I believe in 2014, which is actually, if in the world of these kind of urban development circuits, is actually a quite notable prize to be awarded. But then the very next year, when ITDP put together a list of all BRT systems, it rated Buenos Aires among the lowest. And so what this showed me was that this wasn't really about the technical details and policies. This was about, as the title of the book suggests, chasing world-class urbanism. So trying to create a kind of image that coheres to very dominant urban discourses, what I call a discourse community, kind of at the global level, that prizes the language of sustainability and livability, but isn't very interested, for example, if Buenos Aires actually reduced aggregate CO2 levels, for example. And so I think what I found was that, and this taking this back to the kind of global versus local question, is that the city government found these models appealing because they could do all of these things in the name of urban downtown reinvestment. Without saying so, right? So they could pedestrianize the downtown banking district and attempt through various methods to create a more kind of upscale commercial character to that area, to incentivize cultural activities that middle class people would be interested in, versus the prior users of that space who had been informal vendors, people picking through the trash, for example. So by framing this as a sustainable, livable development that was awarded prizes and lauded by international organizations the world over, they could achieve a high level of legitimacy, while in reality, kind of changing the class character of these areas. And so I don't think I'm quite so cynical as to say sustainability and livability are exactly sort of false discourses, but I think they are discourses that could use more critical scrutiny in particular local contexts. Let me say, because you asked about creativity, which is the next chapter, and I'll try to be kind of brief here. But one thing I found, which I think a lot of urbanists can relate to, is that a lot of these discourses were kind of used interchangeably, right? So, you know, Buenos Aires's local officials were often invoking sustainability, livability, creativity, inclusion, et cetera. And so I wanted to look into creativity in particular a little more. And the city had created basically these thematic districts in the south of the city, which had always been the poorest part of Buenos Aires. And again, this kind of gets to this nexus of local political histories and global models. So a conservative city government talking about social inclusion and exclusion seemed to me to be something novel, the degree of importance that they gave it. And their solution was to create what they called creative districts, which basically provided tax incentives for cultural producers and other tech companies to move into disinvested areas of the city. And I guess to be very kind of brief about it, what I found was that the measure of success for these projects was raising urban land values. And so the city was able to see kind of bringing southern land values up to that of the north of the city or closer to that as a way to foster social inclusion. And so once again, I think a policy that was framed as a kind of industrial or sectoral policy. So there were people in the local legislature who were saying, like, if we really want to incentivize technology and cultural producers, we need a serious public policy. And the city government kind of rejected that. And I think part of why they rejected that is because the discourse of creativity and the kinds of amenities that new development would bring were actually more important than, for example, reshaping industry or providing new forms of employment or reshaping labor markets. These kinds of sectoral, policy-heavy goals that they weren't really that interested in. And the result was that these neighborhoods gained urban amenities and gained higher income residents. And the sort of discourse of creativity did very little to address the kinds of industrial goals that they were said to have had.
So I really loved the final empirical chapter. In fact, I think that was my favorite in the book. And it, you know, as it makes us think beyond the official realm into how citizens respond to these changes and how they adapt to urban transformation. So could you speak a little bit about the kinds of strategies people used or are using, particularly like the vulnerable communities, to survive in Buenos Aires? Or in other words, in your own words, really, how do people make use of everyday culture to survive in a city of culture, and how does this impact social transformation?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So a lot of people have told me that that chapter was the most interesting or easiest, and it does happen to be the chapter that is more ethnographic. So I very much appreciate that. I think one of the things, so this chapter is about going back to the historic center, the neighborhood of San Telmo, and thinking about this large Sunday street fair that brings throngs of tourists, mostly international, but also some local residents, to the neighborhood, and has long been a space of competing priorities between shop owners, informal vendors, etc. I think one of the kind of interventions I wanted to make here, thinking about the voluminous studies on informality in cities of the Global South, was to call into question some of the stark dichotomies that many of us, including myself, often use to understand these situations. So informal versus formal, privileged versus not so privileged. And so I was interested in how local residents, some of them sort of what are called in Argentina or what were called new poor, formerly middle class people who lost their careers as a result of the economic crisis and took up selling goods in the historic center. Often lower income immigrants from neighboring countries who often sold the goods with the least added value. So mass-produced goods, for example. And so I was kind of interested in these different strategies of survival and thinking a little more deeply about how these individuals and social classes, frankly, deploy certain kinds of advantage in order to generate, to be able to make ends meet, so to be able to have the most prized parts of the street. One thing I noticed when I started doing this research is that those individuals furthest from the center of the fair, where most of the international tourism is, were these lower income vendors of immigrants from neighboring countries. And like I said, they were selling things that generated the least added value. So mass-produced keychains, for example, that they would sell to tourists for a few pesos. as you got closer to the fair, you know, to be very frank about it, people became, the vendors, that is, became whiter, lighter in appearance. They tended to be locals as opposed to immigrants. And I think many of them saw themselves as very much in opposition to the local state, who wanted to displace all of them. But at the same time, I was sort of curious about how in this city that is doing so much to incentivize culture, that calls itself the cultural capital of Latin America, how did these individuals use local culture to generate advantage, to make ends meet? And part of what I found is, you know, some of these classic themes in economic sociology. So, for example, artists making hand-produced objects obviously were seen as more valuable. But also thinking about sort of this aura that is produced by certain cultural producers. So, for example, thinking about their modes of self-presentation with international tourists, thinking about their language skills with international tourists. And in the end, kind of circling back to this idea that these are very classed experiences, even in the shadow of the local state that wants to displace all of them. So, of course, you know, there are, most of these vendors are disadvantaged in terms of the legal structure of the city, which sees them as interlopers. And yet we still see how their social class backgrounds really informs or mediates their ability to be on certain parts of the street. And so in the end, I think I kind of shy away from perhaps ideas that would look at certain cultural production and see it as this like heroic vernacular versus crass commercialization. And I think my way of thinking about this was more to was more situational, to try to think about how all of these individuals through various forms of self-presentation are appealing to different legitimizing discourses at different moments, and all shaped by the actions of the state and their ability to mobilize class privilege in order to remain on the street.
You know, and on that note, I would like to shift gears a little bit and ask you, what are you working on now and what can we expect to read from you in the near future?
Yeah, so I think, I guess never say never, but I am trying to move on from Argentina. I live in the Midwest now in Detroit, and, you know, Argentina is a pretty long ways away. And it also, as I think many people feel, it feels like a break to have written the book. I have two projects that are sort of related that I am interested in pursuing here in Michigan, both in Detroit and in Flint. In both of those cities, local officials are attempting to tear down urban highways that were built as part of urban renewal, both of which, that is in Flint and Detroit, tore through predominantly Black neighborhoods and really, you know, destroyed those communities in the 1960s and 70s. And so, as in other parts of the country, there are efforts now to tear out those highways and rebuild the urban grid. And I think for me, it raises a lot of questions about what we mean by urban justice and racial justice and how we think about these projects. Just to sort of tease one aspect of this is, at least in the case of Detroit, the highway in question is really next to some of the most gentrified neighborhoods of the city and quite close to downtown. And so I think there's a kind of tension between, on the one hand, wanting to use the physical rebuilding of the urban grid to kind of right this, this historic wrong, and to think of it as a racial justice project, And on the other side of that, to think how that project could very well further entrench aspects of racialized apartheid in the city. And so that's one thing I'm working on. And then somewhat related, because all of these processes very much entail community engagement from city officials, usually led by city officials and consultants. I've been working on a project that sort of looks at the history of this concept of placemaking, specifically in Detroit, and how historically that term's been used and how today it's being used to reshape particular neighborhoods of the city, and sort of thinking about the multiple understandings that different stakeholders have about that term and how, at least in the contemporary period, it is often used to spur new processes of reinvestment in disinvested neighborhoods.
Wow, that all sounds really interesting. And, you know, like all the best with this work, especially coming out of the pandemic, provisionally at least. I'm sure this is a lot on your plate, and this all sounds really interesting. I wanted to thank you for taking time out to chat with me today about your fantastic new book. It's really such an achievement. So big congratulations again, and hope you're basking in the warmth of the achievements that the book is bound to garner.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun. And it's been great talking, and your questions have actually really helped me also kind of rethink some of these arguments now a year out from publishing the book.
Well, that makes me really happy. So yeah, take care and stay safe.